The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues, the next half hour. I'll be reading articles, at least initially, from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And this is the January 2025 issue of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the first article is about scleroderma. Your rings barely fit your fingers anymore. There's been little weight gain elsewhere, but your fingers have puffed up. They change color in the cold, more so than usual. And to top it off, you've got bad heartburn that keeps you from eating much of anything lately. That mix of symptoms can occur with systemic sclerosis, commonly known as scleroderma. Scleroderma is a group of rare autoimmune diseases that results from overproduction of collagen, a fibrous type of protein in the body's connective tissues. Classic symptoms of the disease are the hardening and tightening of the skin, but the systemic form can have effects far beyond the skin, including in several internal organs. Thankfully, not every person with systemic sclerosis will develop the disease in every organ or will experience every symptom, says Alicia Hines, a rheumatologist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Hines is co-director of the Scleroderma Clinic at Mayo Clinic, and she notes that the disease often can be managed effectively with regular monitoring, lifestyle changes, and medications. The word scleroderma comes from the Greek sclero, meaning hard, and derma, meaning skin. There are two main types of scleroderma. One type typically only involves the skin in adults and is known as morphea. Morphea is distinct from the second type, systemic sclerosis, as it does not involve other organs or blood vessels. In systemic sclerosis, internal organs are nearly always affected in addition to the skin. The disease can be limited to skin thickening below the knees and elbows, called limited scleroderma, or it can be more widespread with thickening that extends to the upper arms, thighs, and trunk. Systemic scleroderma can alter physical appearance if skin thickening involves the face. The disease can damage the blood vessels and affect the digestive tract, lungs, kidneys, heart, joints, and muscles. Women between ages 30 and 60 are most commonly affected. Having a family history of autoimmune conditions is also a risk factor. The symptoms of scleroderma vary based on which body parts are involved. Areas that may be affected include the fingers and toes. One of the earliest signs is an exaggerated response to cold temperatures, which can cause color changes in the fingers or toes and may cause numbness or pain. This phenomenon, called Raynaud's, also occurs in people who don't have scleroderma, but 90% of people with scleroderma have Raynaud's, which is often the first sign and may begin years before skin or organ symptoms begin. Puffy fingers are another important early symptom. Nearly everyone who has scleroderma experiences hardening and tightening of the skin. This first appears in the hands and feet. Skin over the arms, legs, face, and neck can also be affected. Some people also have small red spots called telangiectasias on their hands and face. Another condition, calcinosis, can cause calcium deposits to form under the skin, resulting in bumps that can be seen on x-rays. The skin may be itchy and can appear shiny because it's so tight. Sometimes skin color may get darker or lighter. Many people with scleroderma experience joint pain and stiffness due to tight skin. Inflammation in the joints and tendons, commonly affecting the hands and wrists, also may occur. Some may develop carpal tunnel syndrome. Muscle involvement can lead to weakness. Acid reflux is a common complication. As it progresses, the reflux can damage the section of esophagus nearest the stomach, causing scarring and difficulty swallowing. Also, the disease can cause people to have nausea, vomiting, cramping, diarrhea, and constipation. Systemic disease can affect the heart, lungs, or kidneys to varying degrees. If left untreated, these problems can become life-threatening. If systemic sclerosis progresses and internal organs are affected, complications may occur, including damaged tissue at the fingertips, which leads to slow-to-heal wounds, acid reflux, and trouble swallowing, scarred lung tissue resulting in reduced lung function, sudden rise in blood pressure, kidney complications, including kidney failure, elevated blood pressure in the lungs. This is called pulmonary hypertension. Scarred heart tissue, which increases the risk of irregular heartbeat and heart failure. Dental decay from dry mouth. Chronic constipation. Overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine, which causes bloating, diarrhea, and weight loss, and sexual dysfunction. Many of the complications of scleroderma appear in the first 5 to 7 years, so it's very important to get diagnosed and treated as early as possible. But because scleroderma can take many forms, it can be difficult to diagnose. After doing a physical exam, your healthcare team may recommend blood tests to check for elevated levels of certain antibodies produced by the immune system. In addition, you may have tests to check the function of your lungs, your kidneys, and heart. People suspected to have systemic sclerosis are typically referred to a rheumatologist to confirm the diagnosis, determine proper treatment, and create a monitoring plan. It is important that all people with systemic sclerosis be monitored for pulmonary hypertension, as this can occur at any point, even many years after onset. Monitoring includes regular ultrasound exams of the heart. If additional organs are involved, other specialists may be consulted. The use of medications to suppress the immune system to slow the disease is beneficial for some, but not all people. Immunosuppression is most commonly used for treatment of lung, muscle, or joint symptoms, and for skin symptoms that involve a significant area of the body. The most common first therapy is a drug called mycophenolate mofetil. For muscle or joint inflammation, the first line of treatment is often methotrexate. Many times we are balancing the need to treat multiple complications and may use a combination of therapy or alternate therapies. Recent years have brought promising new treatments for systemic sclerosis that affects the lungs. Nintedanib, or Ofev, was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 2019 to treat scleroderma-associated lung disease. It's a pill you take twice a day. Tocilizumab, or Actemra, received FDA approval in 2021 to treat scleroderma-associated lung inflammation. It's taken by self-injection. Other immunomodulating drugs may be considered, but they are not FDA approved for scleroderma. In very severe disease involving the skin or lungs, stem cell transplant may be an option. These drugs are for specific groups of people with certain types of systemic sclerosis. In general, there is no cure, but treatments can improve your quality of life and slow disease worsening. A variety of medications have been developed to control scleroderma symptoms. The drugs serve to dilate blood vessels. Blood pressure medications that dilate blood vessels, like calcium channel blockers, such as amlodipine and nifedipine, or the phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitor sildenafil or Viagra, may help treat Raynaud's. These medications also may be used to treat pulmonary hypertension. Suppress the immune system. Drugs like mycophenolate mofetil may reduce progression. This option is often used when skin symptoms are widespread or the lungs are significantly affected. Methotrexate also may help, especially with muscle or joint involvement. Reduce stomach acid. Drugs like omeprazole or famotidine can relieve acid reflux. And, of course, omeprazole is Prilosec and famotidine is Pepcid. Relieve pain. If non-prescription pain relievers aren't enough, your care team may prescribe a stronger one. In addition to medication options, physical or occupational therapy can help you manage your pain, improve your strength and mobility, and maintain your independence. And then there's a sidebar about petroleum jelly. Petroleum jelly is a byproduct of oil drilling and was discovered when workers discovered it could help heal wounded skin. Now refined and purified, this inexpensive healing jelly has numerous uses. One is for dry skin. Because it's chemically similar to proteins in the skin, petroleum jelly works as a non-allergenic skin moisturizer. It's helpful for treating dry lips, cracked hands, and leathery heels. It also will soothe irritated eyelids. To prevent blisters, apply petroleum jelly to areas that may rub, like your thighs or feet. Petroleum jelly also acts as a shield to reduce chapping and windburn. Apply a thin layer to exposed skin before going out in cold, windy air. Petroleum jelly can be used to keep minor wounds moist. This prevents scabs from forming. Petroleum jelly can also be used to treat minor burns. It provides a chemically neutral barrier between burned skin and the air. Apply it 2 to 3 times daily to promote healing and reduce pain. Using it on a fresh burn can trap initial inflammatory heat and increase discomfort. So before applying, run the burn under cool water until the heat has dissipated. Eczema. You can soften crusty, flaky skin with a light application. And dry, brittle nails. Petroleum jelly is a great option for rehydrating dry cuticles. Apply to damp nails between polishes to minimize brittleness and prevent chipping. For best results, apply to damp skin using clean hands or an applicator like a cotton swab. Petroleum jelly is generally not flammable except in the presence of high oxygen levels. Never apply petroleum jelly-based products when using oxygen equipment. Now let's go to the section of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter called Second Opinion. Question. My incontinence medication is so helpful, but I just read it could increase my dementia risk. What are my options? Some urinary incontinence drugs are linked to memory issues. While these older drugs are quite effective and inexpensive, it may be time to consider other available options. Anticholinergic drugs like oxybutynin, tolteridine, and sulfafenicin have long been mainstays in treating forms of urinary incontinence. And these drugs have names like Detrol and Vesicare. These drugs work by blocking the action of the chemical messenger acetylcholine. Acetylcholine sends a signal to your brain that triggers bladder contraction. When this feedback loop doesn't work properly, it can lead to an overactive bladder. As with any drug, side effects are possible, and one important concern is the potential for effects on the brain. Anticholinergics may cause confusion, agitation, and hallucinations. These effects typically go away when the drug is stopped, but research shows that long-term use of these drugs, oxybutynin and sulfafenicin, remember that's Detrol and Vesicare, in particular, increase the risk of dementia. The American Geriatric Society lists anticholinergic as potentially inappropriate drugs for older adults. They should be used only when the benefits outweigh the risks and at lower doses when possible. For people with existing cognitive impairment or dementia, these drugs are best avoided. Talk with your healthcare team about what medication, if any, would be best for you. Some newer anticholinergics called trospium and darafenicin don't appear to have the same cognitive effects. The drugs mibetric and gemtesa or vibegron in a class called beta-3 adrenergic agonists have not been linked to dementia. Injections of Botox might be used for some types of incontinence, or non-drug therapies like inserts. Electrical stimulation or surgery may be recommended. Remember that there are effective non-drug strategies. These include bladder training, where you slightly delay urination after you get the urge to go, and then progressively lengthen the delay. Scheduled trips to the bathroom. Reduced liquid consumption. Avoid alcohol, caffeine, and acidic foods. Pelvic floor exercises like Kegels. Ask your care team for help. You might also benefit from a referral to a pelvic floor physical therapist. And then there's a question, my joints and muscles get sore the day after an exercise class. Could cold plunges and ice baths help? Although cold therapy has become popular in recent years, the concept isn't new. It's the I in the RICE formula, which is R-I-C-E. And the RICE formula stands for rest, ice, compression, and elevation. RICE is a common strategy for treating injured or sore areas of the body. Cold water immersion may reduce the degree of whole body exercise-induced muscle damage that can occur after physically challenging activities. Less damage leads to less inflammation, which reduces soreness and helps restore physical performance in the short term. Ice also restricts blood flow, slows nerve signaling, and reduces swelling, all of which may reduce delayed onset stiffness and pain. For these reasons, cold therapy may help reduce pain and soreness after hard training. It also may temporarily blunt the pain of a headache or a sore knee, as well as help you bounce back from an injury more quickly. Cold therapy can slow your recovery if used too often. Constricted blood vessels can limit the blood circulation that's essential for tissue healing. If you resistance train, cold water immersion may turn down the molecular signaling pathways that are normally activated after exercise. Both may hinder long-term improvement. Consider cold therapy soon after a particularly tough workout. That's when it can help reduce swelling and pain. If the sore area is small, apply an ice pack for 15 to 20 minutes. Repeat every 2 to 3 hours. For larger areas, immerse yourself in cold water. Fill a bathtub with cold water, add some ice, and submerge yourself for a few minutes. Or for a more proactive approach, choose heat most of the time. Use a heat pad, warm bath, or hot tub for 15 to 20 minutes. Repeat as needed, allowing at least an hour between sessions. The heat-induced increase in blood flow may promote tissue healing through improved nutrient delivery, oxygen delivery, and clearance of waste products. Now here's another article of interest, which is entitled Testosterone Therapy for Men. Helpful for some, but often not needed. You may have seen ads making bold claims, feel younger, get stronger, improve your sex drive. The ads tend to be for therapies that include a synthetic replacement for testosterone, a naturally occurring hormone. Testosterone plays a vital role in the external development of genital organs and secondary sex characteristics like deep voice and facial hair. Marketers tend to target middle-aged and older men since levels of the hormone fall with age. However, experts agree that testosterone is not a miracle drug that will cure all problems. It comes with some important risks. The Food and Drug Administration has only approved testosterone therapy for low testosterone with a clear medical cause. In addition to affecting voice and facial hair, testosterone impacts other parts of the body, including bone density, blood pressure, and the creation of red blood cells. It's produced primarily in the testicles, and testosterone therapy varies greatly among men. Women make testosterone in their ovaries and adrenal glands, but they make much less. Testosterone levels generally peak during adolescence and early adulthood. As men age, testosterone levels gradually decline, about 1% a year after age 30 or 40. For older men, it's important to determine if low testosterone is due to typical aging or if it's due to hypogonadism. This is a condition that hampers the ability to produce usual amounts of testosterone due to a problem with the testicles or with the pituitary gland. The risk of hypogonadism increases as men get older. A rare condition present at birth may be the cause, or hypogonadism may develop due to obesity, diabetes, injury to the testicles, pituitary tumors, or radiation treatment. The condition also may occur with use of drugs like opioids, cannabis, or chemotherapy agents. To be diagnosed with hypogonadism, you need to have two factors. First is low testosterone levels. This needs to be confirmed by at least two blood tests taken on separate days. There isn't a standard low level, but Mayo Clinic experts consider 240 nanograms per deciliter to be the lowest healthy limit. Then there are symptoms, which may include decreased sexual desire, less energy, depression, loss of muscle mass, reduced body hair growth, development of breast tissue, or loss of bone density. Further testing can help determine the cause. Sometimes this cause may be reversible, but at other times testosterone therapy may be considered. This therapy, in the form of injections, pellets, patches, or gels, may improve the symptoms of low testosterone. Men who don't have hypogonadism will likely experience some of the symptoms of aging described above, although not as severely. Some of these symptoms can be caused by other factors like medication side effects, obstructive sleep apnea, thyroid problems, diabetes, and depression. It's also possible that these conditions are causing low testosterone levels. Treating the condition might increase testosterone levels without the need for testosterone replacement. Testosterone replacement therapy can help reverse the effects of hypogonadism, but it's unclear whether it would help older men who are otherwise healthy. Although some men believe that they feel younger and more vigorous when they take testosterone therapy, there's little evidence to support its use in otherwise healthy men. Guidelines from the American College of Physicians indicate that testosterone therapy might improve sexual function somewhat in some men, but there's little evidence that it improves vitality and energy. Testosterone therapy can worsen sleep apnea, cause acne, stimulate non-cancerous growth of the prostate called benign prostate hyperplasia, enlarge the breasts, limit sperm production, and stimulate too much red blood cell production, which increase the risk of blood clots and pulmonary embolism. Testosterone replacement therapy has also been linked to an increased risk of heart disease, but recent research has found little to support that connection. If you have an age-related change and want to address your symptoms, talk with your healthcare team. Often treating other health conditions, changing medication, or improving lifestyle factors, including losing excess weight and doing regular weight training exercises, can have a significant positive impact. Once you understand what's causing symptoms, you can develop solutions. Testosterone therapy is just one option. Knowing the benefits and risks can help you to have an informed and honest conversation with your care team. Now, let's briefly go over an article on aspirin in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And it says, Taking a low-dose aspirin on a regular basis is fairly common for older adults. A recent survey found that 25% of adults aged 50 to 80 take the clot-reducing drug 3 times a week, or more frequently. But emerging research has painted a complicated picture, showing benefits not as strong as once believed, and spotlighting risks of long-term aspirin use. National guidelines have been updated that suggest a more cautious approach to the common practice. Up to half of the older adults currently taking low-dose aspirin should reconsider, as the benefits may not outweigh the risks. And what are these risks? Well, side effects and complications of regularly taking aspirin include stroke caused by a burst blood vessel. While daily aspirin can help prevent a clot-related stroke, it increases the risk of bleeding stroke. A bleeding stroke is also called a hemorrhagic stroke. It will also increase the risk of gastrointestinal bleeding, or bleeding from the stomach or intestinal wall. If you already have a stomach ulcer, have liver disease, or use other blood-thinning medications, taking aspirin can cause more bleeding. A decision to take aspirin therapy depends on many factors. Research on the topic continues to evolve, producing conflicting or confusing recommendations. In 2022, the Preventive Task Force issued guidelines for aspirin use. The guidelines take into account the latest research. And basically what the guidelines say is that you should take aspirin if you're between 40 and 59 and are at high risk of having a first-time heart attack or stroke. If you haven't had a heart attack but you've had coronary bypass surgery or a stent placed, or if you're younger than 60 and have diabetes and at least one other heart disease risk factor. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.